My brother Nicholas is a man of action and ideas, and sometimes I wonder if he was born in the wrong century or centuries before. He spent 31 years in the Foreign Service of the U.S. government, in the intelligence community. He's a writer now, retired from the government and in corporate life, living in Europe. And he's our guest on the Chicago Way podcast. Nick has just written an outstanding piece for the American Conservative magazine under this title, Lessons from a Turkish Coup. The country that invented the deep state teaches us how it can be dealt with. And the parallels between Turkey and the United States are striking. Between Turkey going through coups, the deep state, the Kemalists there, and the United States now since the Trump years of the Russia collusion host, and perhaps before, the Washington establishment becomes the American Kemalists. And if there's anyone who knows about the Kemalists in Turkey and the Kemalists in Washington and the deep state, it is Nicholas Spiridon Cass, my brother Nick. When we were young and working in the butcher shop of our family store, Nick was also working towards his black belt in Kyokushin Karate. He'd disappear into the meat cooler and throw left hooks at the hanging cattle, just like Rocky Balboa. And our dad hated that. Years later, he disappeared into his books and papers at Georgetown University. And then later, he'd disappear into Turkey, Syria, wherever. We didn't know. The U.S. government knew where he was, but we didn't know. And he never talked about his work. Our mom didn't like that, because moms want to know everything. He's now retired, as I said, and can talk some, having served 31 years, mostly as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Director of Intelligence at the White House, National Security Council, Deputy National Intelligence Office for Europe, and the National Intelligence Council, and at CIA. I've been to some of those secret award ceremonies where he's received the highest awards, but they didn't talk specifics, and he didn't talk much about them either. But he can talk now. He's in the private sector now, in international corporate affairs, at the Alexandrian Group, headquartered near Bucharest, Romania. And he's our guest on the Chicago Way podcast. Jeff Carlin is here as always, co-host, executive producer at WGN Radio, master of sound, future physics teacher, my friend. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, editor-in-chief of your favorite website for common sense, John Cass News. And where are you with the elites and their Kemalists pulling the strings, and you don't even feel where the strings are, but you can kind of just sense them tugging at you? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
I've known our next guest for more than 60 years.
Oh my God.
He was until his recent retirement, the America's preeminent expert on Turkey and the Aegean, fluent in many languages, and also a diplomat, respected, honored, and diplomat who has received many awards from his country for his service. And also, he used to pound the carcasses of cattle that were hanging in my dad's butcher shop, because he'd throw left hooks and try to break their ribs, just like Rocky. I don't know how he became the person he became, but I'm glad, and our country's glad that he did. He is Nicholas Spiridon Cass, my younger brother, Nick, whose article in the American Conservative is just astounding. Lessons from a Turkish coup. The country that invented the deep state teaches how it can be dealt with. Nick, welcome to the Chicago Way once again.
Yeah, and thank you, John. Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be back. Really enjoy being on the podcast. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, people liked it when you were on the last podcast, and they loved the photograph you sent in that we used.
Yeah, it was cool.
It was so like Lawrence of Olivier. I should wake up. There's a time difference.
What? Yeah. We're Nick, where are we catching now? If you can let us know, or roughly where you are in the world, because you're well traveled.
Yes, I'm in a village north of Bucharest right now, in a beautiful little place, and just enjoying the day as I sit here with my dog at my side, and the family all dispersed, the kids and my wife are traveling, but I'll be joining them soon.
Oh, I love it. Well, thanks for coming on, because it is, John's right. It's a great piece. I mean, there's a lot, as they like to say, there's a lot to unpack here, but yes. It really, it highlights an era where people think all these deep state conspiracies or things like that may be just nonsense. It's like, you're overplaying it, or you're overworking it, or you're emphasizing it. But you draw out a lot of really interesting parallels to history that are parallel to everything now. But just the idea that things like coups, like people were actually very close to taking power from other countries and this country. And it just feels like everybody should read this to really understand what we're living through right now.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I wanted to try to write it in a way that if people were listening and reading it and taking it seriously, then I didn't want anything to get in the way and obscure that experience for them, because I do think that people really need to start paying attention to this issue in a big way. And, it is the case that, many people just are interested more in either promoting this idea of a deep state or in dismissing it as a conspiracy theory. And it always reminds me of that line, and I think it's Godfather 2, when Michael says, "Who's being naive, Kay?" I always think that's a good one, because
Michael, presidents and senators don't have people killed.
Exactly.
Said America's first Karen.
Right.
America's first Karen. Yeah.
Right. And so I didn't want to get into like the polemics about it, but because the situation, the historical record, what you see with your own, the evidence of your own eyes is standing enough, I think. And so I just want people to really focus and pay attention, because this is a real problem for us going ahead. And if we don't take care of it, it's going to get worse. And I think what happened in Turkey was a perfect illustration of how things can go. And I don't want that to happen. So it would be good if people just settled down, took a breath, and quit trying to demonize and ostracize half the country because they didn't like the guy who was the president. So in any event, that's what kind of that was the situation that kind of was on my mind. But what compelled me to write it was really just the parallel. It was a very, very vivid parallel. And you started to see it emerge, a number of years ago. Rather than just go on in a monologue, I'll let you guys talk about it a little bit.
No, it's you made a decision to write clearly and analytically about an important subject. And you did not want to get in the, you didn't want to be on the list of guests on those talk shows, either the left or the right, where the moderator or host is braying like some jackass conspiracy or coup, you know,
right.
Deep state, and they don't know what they're talking about.
Right, exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's many, many of them, many of them out there who are just trying to drive the sheep into the chutes before slaughter.
Right.
It's the same thing that happens here, you know, in America all the time with
politics. Well, I mean, you see that happening, and I guess perhaps we should probably start delving into the topic at hand here. But I wrote this article on the 25th anniversary of a coup d'etat in Turkey, which is known as the February 28th process or the postmodern coup. It was a formative and seminal event in Turkish history, and it was different from the normal or traditional military takeover putsch where they just drove tanks in the streets like they did previously in Turkey, in which they tried again in 2016, but was a much more subtle and behind-the-scenes orchestrated event. And it just was too eerily similar to some of the things that you saw in the United States over the last six or so years. And I thought maybe if we really looked at it, we could see what was going on and maybe shed some light on it and some draw some lessons from it. I mean, I was just looking at some of the media coverage of President Trump's immediate, you know, sort of the period right after he was inaugurated. And there were people talking about coups d'etat as a real viable option.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So we think about that. Think about this in America that people were actually talking about that because they didn't like this guy. And okay, it's fair enough. You don't want to start to get to that extreme where you start to talk about saving, you know, destroying democracy in order to save it. And there's too much of that going on. And I think people should pay attention to what this means. In the case of Turkey, it was a very an idiosyncratic and say non-conventional politician, a guy named Necmettin Erbakan, who was leading a pro-Islam party, which steadily and over time built up strength and eventually emerged as a challenger to the establishment, the Turkish establishment, which was then dominated by what we would call the Kemalists, a very, very secularist, very, very rigidly ideological organization, party, and state apparatus. They saw this guy as a threat, and then they tried to do everything they could to take him down, even if it meant sowing the seeds for some real, some consequences down the road. And I think they did that. And part of what you're seeing in Turkey since then and today is a direct consequence of that event. So people should be really careful about what they wish for and how they go about trying to get rid of their political opponents, because these things do have implications and they do have, spillover effects that perhaps aren't that are not easily accounted for, cannot easily be predicted. Sure, something to worry about.
Collateral damage, right? I mean, geez, you're talking like, and people talk about like, you know, it was mass destabilization. No, there are no happy coups, right? There are no good coups that happened well or
well, there was one in the movie Zorro, I think, that was pretty good when, they all came back, all the rich lords kicked out the populace, and then that was a good coup as they all hoisted their swords up at the and Tyrone Power was running around. But generally, no, coups are not a good thing. What?
Yeah, Basil Rathbone dies in that one, unfortunately.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But anyway, but I did want to point out one thing. I mean, the idea of the deep state has an old pedigree, and the importance of it is that it is a concept that comes from Turkey, which is one of the reasons why I've been talking about Turkey so much so far. But it's not just the question of the bureaucracy run amok. I mean, there's always a problem with any developed state, any administrative state, of a bureaucracy that is less than responsive to political leaders. I mean, these are sort of, there are things that happen that are just a consequence of the kind of state that we live in. So that's problematic enough. But what we're talking about in the case of Turkey in those days were these illegal and unofficial networks involving the highest levels of society, the security services, some of the politicians, the oligarchs, the media, the academic infrastructure, everybody who was working almost in defiance of the political, in defiance of the legitimately elected political authorities of the country. And that takes these
They loathed them. And why did they loathe them? Why was there such loathing between the soft-handed bureaucrats and the generals and the education bureaucrats and all the rest, all the politicians loyal to the regime that we might call the establishment of today?
Well, the Kemalists were committed to a very, very radical secularist ideology and state in which they tried to basically create a new type of person in Turkey, a new Turk, you know, as the Turks would of the coup period would tell me, Tek Tip Insan, you know, they all wanted to make one kind of man, kind of like a new Soviet man was basically the idea.
Right.
And of course they had, they despised the Turkish religious and other traditions. They, you know, didn't even recognize who the Kurds were, for example, because these things were threats to the ascendancy of the Kemalist regime and its ability to manipulate power, money, etc., for their own ends. If you started to sort of grant that there were realities existing outside the parameters of your narrow ideological worldview, you start to lose power. And they didn't want that. And so they set up this rather repressive state. In 1960, there was a coup d'etat, which led to the hanging of the prime minister. In 1971, people were so spooked that a mere memorandum from the military was enough to bring the government down. In 1980, the military took over directly in the wake of left-right violence on the streets, which, of course, was probably obviously very, very deeply rooted that hadn't been solved and hadn't been addressed for the entire length of the Kemalist Republic when it was founded in 1923. These things were allowed to fester and they emerged.
And anarchy is also a tool of...
Of course it is.
And I'm sorry, Nick, but I'm going to draw some parallels over your objections here.
No, why would I object?
The parallels that I see, the problem I see first is that you spent your career, your life, more than 30 years in the Department of State, and according to your biography in the piece at the American Conservative, you also served at the CIA for a time. And professionals, true professionals in the field that you're in and are in, probably have difficulty like trying to express or let their clients, meaning the government and our leaders, know what's going on when that has to be filtered through the very regime types in this country that oppose any knowledge of it, that don't want it to be discussed, that the thing that shouldn't be mentioned.
Yeah.
So, for example, in Turkey, the rise of the Islamic, I wouldn't say state, but the rise of the of Islamic feeling in the country after having so long been repressed must have been a difficult issue for you personally to translate to policymakers here when any mention of Islam in the in discussion would be, you know, cause them to cringe because we had demonized Islam in this country for political reasons and war reasons.
Right.
And you're trying to say, hey guys, can you just step out of your box and listen to what I'm saying to you? They don't want to hear it.
Right. I mean, I would put it just for the sake of this conversation, I'll refrain from putting it into, the sort of back and forth of my own experiences in that respect. But I'll say more broadly that when you adopt an ideological view of the world, whether it's, you know, we're going to make the world safe for democracy, or whether we're going to fly rainbow flags, and that's going to be the most important issue of the day.
Yeah.
It cannot help but constrain people's ability to perceive accurately what's really going on the ground out there. We've talked about this before. How do you know what you know? Well, I mean, one of the things you really need to know is how to understand the events you're seeing or experiencing or being, you know, whether firsthand or remotely, in primarily in the terms in which they are being played out there, and not to apply your own ideological filter, which explains everything in ways that are palatable to the Washington, you know, the big Washington apparatus.
Right.
So, because otherwise you're just going to be missing the entire story. It's like looking for your keys under the street light because the light's there, but you really lost them in the alley in the back, right? It's
right.
not going to help you. It's actually going to be very, very harmful. And you see that all the time. I mean, people, you know, create, you know, they pick favorites. They say, you know, this, these are the good guys. These are the bad guys. These are the guys who are on our side. They promote our values, even in the face of evidence that suggests that they don't. And when you're in that kind of a situation, it can be really disastrous for foreign policy and for the American people if indeed the policy is not grounded in a real appreciation of reality. Now, you know, realism itself can be an ideology. So I'm not, you know, anything with an ism on it, frankly, probably be an ideology. So I try not to do that. So my approach to this is really simple. I try to go out like I would try to go out as I do now in my life here, understand what's going on in the language, in terms of the language, the culture, the aspirations, the hopes of the people who are out here, who are the generators for whatever events are going on here. Understand those first, and then try to convey those back to people who would be able to be responsible for making political decisions, policy decisions. Now, so it, that has to be the case. And if you're not doing that, you're asking for a lot of trouble. And I think we've had a number of instances in the last 30, 40 years where that has been, we've paid the price for that. And I think it's time now, as the world is changing and the structure of the, you know, global, you know, sort of environment is changing, that we need to be a little bit more nimble. We need to be a little bit more proactive in terms of understanding what our own core interests are, and having a real strategic sense. And having strategic sense means having a sense of what the limitations are. You know, you can't do, if you think you have unlimited money and unlimited funds, there's no strategy. You just do everything, right? It was like, that's how Mayor Daley governed Chicago for a long time. Yeah, right? So, but if you respect the fact that there are challenges and realities out there that put constraints on you, then you need to start thinking strategically about what your priorities are. And it's high time we did that. But
we are talking to Nicholas Spiridon Cass. Nick Cass, my brother, a longtime 30-plus year diplomat with the Department of State, involved in what we formally call the intelligence community. And Nick, I just have to tell you, I'm going to forward this piece of yours in the American Conservative to Andrew McCarthy, who we had on a while back.
Okay.
And I mentioned, I don't know where I got this idea, but I mentioned to him that we were talking about his book, Collateral Damage,
right.
The deep state's reaction to President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned the phrase American Kamalists, and he And McCarthy was like, oh, I really liked that. And I hope I said on the tape, yes, my brother came up with it, or maybe I didn't, because I don't know.
You've written about it.
Yes, I have written about it. I wonder where we get ideas, you know, maybe from talking to smart people and playing them. I am going to forward this to him, and I recommend all of you out there read The American Conservative, which is actually quite a subversive magazine now.
Yeah.
Under Helen Andrews, it is just, I love it. And I list it on my website, John Cass News, is something I read constantly, and I do. And we're going to try to get a copy of it to reprint. I don't know. I've emailed her and I've asked permission. So we'll see if we get that. But
yeah.
I have to now, I don't want to do a monologue. I just want to ask my brother a question. When you see the January 6th committee to bring it to, you know, what's going on today, when you see a committee of no opposition, you know, there's usually all committees in our Congress would have people on the one side and the other, one party and the other, together discussing an issue. But in this one, basically, this is just one-sided. And with Adam Kinzinger and what's her name? I almost said the little princess of Halliburton, but yes, that is Cheney, isn't it? When you see the tears of Kinzinger dripping from his face, I wonder, do you ever what's your core feeling about it?
Well, I find it it's kind of revolting, and here's why. I mean, I think that if you were looking at this happening in Ruritania, right, and you saw exactly this kind of stuff happening in Ruritania, you wouldn't have any illusions about what's going on. You would look at it and say, okay, this is how they're doing it. It's interesting that they don't have anybody on the committee who is actually challenging, the single point of view. Maybe Freedom House or some other NGO should look at that and make a comment about what's happening in Ruritania, right? But that doesn't happen. And I think the larger question is not that that people don't understand. I mean, and sometimes, you know, you think you're in a position where you're like, no, I think it's just, you know, if all I have to do is explain this clearly and people will see, it's not about that anymore. I think we've gone beyond that. We're at the point of frontier warfare now, at least politically in the United States. And people know that, I suspect, this is very, very dubious, but they don't particularly care. And that is the big problem, because if you look at the case I laid out in Turkey about Turkey, you know, you had this coup d'etat in 1997. They brought down this government. They banned the political leader. They kept him out of politics for the rest of his life. They banned his associates, the guy who's now Recep Tayyip Erdogan was mayor of Istanbul, and he was stripped of his office and kicked out of office and, you know, was banned from politics and blah, blah, blah. They closed the party. The problem is...
What was the effect of all that?
Well, the effect of all that was to have people double down rather than intimidate his supporters. That just taught them a real hard lesson, which was, this is the way it's going to happen here. So this is the way politics is going to be played. Then we're going to do it this way, right?
You've referenced frontier warfare.
Yeah.
Jeff just said the word vicious, and frontier warfare and vicious means when one side takes out the tomahawks, the other side takes out the tomahawks,
right?
And there's
it's the opening line of this podcast, John. When he brings the gun, you bring a knife. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's scary, and you're right. I mean, I feel like one of the common threads among everything left, right, center, is this idea that there are forces that are like pulling everybody, you know, to the far edges of everything, and then amping them up just so they can turn around and attack essentially the center of this country. Because it's not, I mean, they're not attacking the far right. They're attacking the center of this country. That's what the crazy part is. And like you guys said, it's become normalized.
Well, there's a couple of things. One, I studied, taught karate for a number of years, as you guys know. Tomahawks were not one of my weapons, but what I do know about them is that they're actually offensive weapons. It's not like you're fencing with them. And parrying and nice right posts and nice techniques. You're just basically running up to a person and trying to be, you know, get that, bury that thing in there as quickly as you can. Okay. It's an aggressive, very, very violent, offensive weapon. And that's a good metaphor for the politics of the age. So I don't think, again, I think the problem is if we're doing a stand back look at it, you can say, yes, well, the extremes are now, you know, both operating this way, and the center is suffering as a result. That probably is the case. But I would say also that you really have to look at who were the groups that were in power, how long they were doing this, and whether or not the expectation was that the people that they were, kind of keeping down politically were going to continue just sort of submitting for a while. And I think what you've seen in the politics in America is a big change on that. And it's partly accompanied by the rise of populism, partly this sense that people aren't going to get a fair shake. I think what it's breeding is a sense that, okay, if you're going to, you know, do a February 28th process on me, just wait till we get in office and we're going to do the same to you, and you can scream all you want about it. Right. Mm-hmm. So
is
I think that
is that not coming? Is that not coming?
If we, well, it's already happened, I think.
This constant attack by the American Kemalists on the Trump forces is not going to work out, I think, well for the country, because there's no then the other side pulls out the tomahawks like Magwan in that movie, The Deer Slayer. What was it?
Right. Last of the Mohicans.
Last of the Mohicans. Right. And then you have the tomahawks out, and everybody's got tomahawks in their hands. Right. And then the centrists, the so-called centrists who played the game, wring their hands and weep and say, oh, my God, I didn't mean for this to happen. We didn't want this to happen. Right. Yes, you did. You allowed this to happen. You encouraged it. And now reap the benefits of your, you know, feast.
And those are certainly, and that's certainly a path that this could go down. And when I looked at the Turkey example, of course, you had the coup in 1997, which was extraordinarily ham-fisted, ham-handed. The media just claiming that, you know, these guys were going to launch an armed insurrection. They were theocrats. I mean, the parallels were just shocking, actually. They leapt out at me so clearly in that respect. So there was a coup. It was orchestrated. The media played a big role in setting the stage, telling people that they should be scared and all of that sort of thing. Obviously the bureaucrats, the security and other places had their say in terms of leveraging their power to condemn via the media, but also through the controlled judiciary, that these people were going to be punished for their sins of not going along with the Kemalist viewpoint. So that happened, but a few years later, the situation in Turkey had become so bad that the orchestrated governments, the governments who were allowed to run the country after that, at least nominally, were such colossal failures that they started to discredit. They heaped discredit upon discredit. In other words, the February 28th process in Turkey, in a country that was not one that had been democratic from its inception, was learning about democracy. I mean, we talk in America about, you know, we are the great American experiment, right? Well, imagine a country like Turkey or any other country in that region where, you know, democracy is still seen as, you know, something, or was seen as something as an outside import to the society, to the state, mm-hmm. a replacement of, you know, maybe God's law with man-made law. These are serious issues for any kind of civilization. And so it's an experiment there. And then people are taught, 1997, following on the heels of 1960, 1971, 1980, this is what you mean by democracy. Okay, then this is the way we're going to play it from now on. And so the damage was really, really incredible. But the AKP, which was the successor to this Refah Party that was run by Necmettin Erbakan, they came back into power. They took advantage of the fact that the secularist, ideologically secularist governments had failed so catastrophically to win an election in 2002. And at that point, you could have thought to yourself, well, maybe the Kemalists will learn a lesson. They'll figure out, you know, this ultimately doesn't work. If we're going to pretend, if we're going to have a constitutional order that gives lip service to democracy, then we can't really just, you know, run roughshod over it. But that's not what happened. And so the pressure campaign started again on Erdogan this time, including, you know, what was known as the judicial coup attempt. It was a military orchestrated effort by the Turkish Constitutional Court to outlaw the AKP back in 2008. There were a whole series of other things that in this piece, I noted that there were probably at least four military coups in Turkey, plus the failed putsch in 2016. The reason why I said at least four is because depending on the way you look at subsequent events, one might be able to argue that there were actually more sort of behind the scenes coup attempts going on. So it was a real kind of messy period, but it did teach a whole generation of Turkish activists, politicians, voters that this is what they could expect from the establishment. And, you know, we're seeing the results of that obviously now. So we're in this weird period. I think we, you know, if you were to analogize, you know, the previous era in America to the February 28th process, we're now approaching an election where you're probably going to see the Republicans of some sort come back in a big way in 2022, maybe in 2024. Who knows? A lot of time between them. And then the question is going to be what happens after that? Are we going to say, is the system going to say, okay, look, we have to bow to this reality. We don't like these deplorables, right, with their, you know, with their strange ways out in, you know, the middle of the country, but
in Iowa, and Central Illinois, and Indiana,
in the South, in Turkey, it was also the central hinterlands and the southeast, and it's kind of geographically interesting, the parallel there as well in the United States. So, people will have a choice. I mean, the people have spoken. There is a decision that has been rendered. What are people going to do now? The problem that the Kemalists had in accepting that was because they were so ideologically committed to a particular course of action, and not only ideologically, but their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor, their status in society was all linked up with the perpetuation of the status quo that was this Kemalist status quo, that they didn't want to let it go. And as a result of that, you saw the kinds of behavior and activity that happened in Turkey after the AKP emerged and won elections in 2002 and subsequently. And then, of course, by 2016, there was an open effort by military coup d'etat effort that, you know, backfired spectacularly and led to a huge purge on the other side. The government decided, okay, if this is the way you're doing it, this is what's going to happen. Now,
and then you had military officers having to decide which side they were on. The duly elected side or the Kemalist regime waiting,
right?
And it became chaos and frightening to the American people, the Turkish people, right?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was a mess, and it was definitely avoidable. It didn't have to happen that way, but I think the unwillingness to learn the lessons of the unwillingness of the Kemalist establishment to learn the lessons of of their coup in 1997, and their unwillingness to accept that what you sow you reap, ultimately I think led to precisely the outcomes that we have today. And what I find in America is that you're seeing a lot of people are talking about, not in the Turkish sense. Again, it's the Turks did this, we can do it. That's not
right.
The issue is, do things unfold in this way? And is there a way to change it perhaps in a less, more edifying way? And, but you're seeing now a lot of people are, I think, sharing a lot of the point of view that many of the supporters of, the then opposition in Turkey shared, amongst themselves and in their opposition to the establishment, which was, we're not going to get a fair shake. So, you know, there'll be, you know, we're, you know, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And it's one thing in a country like Turkey, where I say the tradition, the democratic tradition was long, but also very, very problematic and troubling given the sort of civilizational differences between, Western Europe, where democracy reemerged after a couple thousand years, and a country like Turkey, which had its own ancient, very, very sophisticated, rich, extraordinary, and ancient tradition of its own, culture and political traditions of its own. And then to consider how do we, graft democracy on that, you can imagine the problem with that, right? So that was a challenge. But the very fact that it's happening in the United States, or at least in some respects happening among elite elements in the United States, is very troubling, because it tells you how quickly you can burn through that crust of, democratic tradition to reveal the power-hungry bureaucrats underneath. And I think we've seen enough of that. Certainly had enough of that when you think about all the comments that various people made about treason and traitors and all of this kind of thing in what we now know was basically an completely made up and trumped up accusations against the president. So, you don't have to, and it's not a question of whether or not you like a particular guy. It's a question of, man, why did this happen? So I tried to, when I wrote the paper, the article, I tried to write it in a way such that people could get past their own personal preferences and just look at this analytically, like you would if you were looking at it abroad. Again, we talked a little bit about Ruritania, but if you're looking at a country abroad, you can't look at it you cannot do your job by looking at a situation in a faraway country and say, these are the guys I like, these are the guys I don't like. That's not the job of a person who's going to be doing the analysis. What a policymaker does is something different. But what an analyst has to do is to find out what's going on its own terms. And if you can't do that, you're doomed.
If you can't do that, you're just a propagandist.
Yeah.
And like many journalists of today, I would have, I shudder to say it.
Yeah,
I shudder to say it, but I look at my Twitter feed and I see former colleagues, clearly Jacobins, saying things like all Republicans are fascists and all Republicans are, particularly conservatives, should be purged. And I always think in these terms that what happens, not about me, but what happens when the tomahawk is in the other hand.
Like, what's the consequence?
Yeah.
What are the consequences of framing the issue in those terms, where you're basically taking half the country and telling them that they're the enemy? Seriously, what do people expect?
Destabilizing over time.
Right. I mean, it's like the most colossally short-sighted foolish approach to governance or approach to politics even than I've ever seen. And
unless, of course, you're hoping for tomahawk frontier war throughout the American political system.
Well, yeah, that's it. What's the means? Are they justifying the ends there? I mean,
my question would be, to what end? Right. So, I mean, you can do that. You can create instability.
The destruction of the system.
Right.
If you're a committed ideologue of the left, then you've just left the newspaper and now you're free to give your own opinions, and you begin to, pass out tomahawks.
Well, the problem with the extreme left, which is not often analyzed as thoroughly as I would certainly like it, is that, you're right. The goal is not the particular policy that they may be pursuing, whether it's some sort of environmental this or that or the other thing. I mean, all of these things are debatable issues that could be people of goodwill can disagree or agree on all of these policies. But I think the real victory is the destruction and the dismantling of the apparatus of the current state. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, then you're in good position to be able to pick up and try to see what you can build out of that. We talked about this, I think, on one of the our earlier podcast conversations, where I said I thought that the sort of woke people will ultimately fail in the sense that their policies will not gain traction. They will fail. And you're seeing actually now, I think, a year or two on, a lot of that happening in some of these areas where people are just becoming more and more aware of the absolute insanity that's being pushed as a matter of policy by some of these folks. But they could still win if they destroy the, you know, if what they've done in the process is so discredited, so discredit the old understanding that, you know, it's just a bunch of fragments lying on the ground. And then you have to retreat back to the monasteries of Ireland to sort of, hang out
to save the,
yeah, world. Right. Well, my fear and all that, and you kind of alluded to that, is that earlier that sure, that might be their goal and that what they hope they can, you know, oh, we're going to rebuild it better on the other side. That's great, but they don't have a good track record of being far-sighted on things like this. They're very nearsighted on everything. And the world may not be the way they want it is on the other side of destabilizing everything, because there are other powers at play in the world and people are, you know, other interests. So I fear that we're just going to be in a tailspin and it just chaos for a long time. If people don't wake up to the idea that it's, you know, this is not a game you just play lightly. I mean, we're talking about society. We're talking about bedrock institutions, and it's,
well, you're talking about perceptions of reality, basic reality, and you know, that's it's. I mean, the thing. I mean, it's amazing how you have to be careful about what you say in various, you know, places down in D.C. or Washington, mm-hmm. or what, you know, the things that you have to assume, the things that people will tell you about their own view, which is almost an assertion of power as opposed to like an effort to sort of talk about an issue. So, for example, you read some of these things, you read somebody is posting on their Twitter feed or LinkedIn their position on Clarence Thomas or whatever it is. Okay, fine, great. You know, mm-hmm. you can have a difference of opinion. But the aggressiveness and the hostility with which it's couched suggests, one, that this is obviously deeply felt, almost a religious sort of feeling, whatever the issue is. But secondly, that they're not inviting you to say, well, you know, I have a little bit of a slightly different view. You know, they're not saying that because they want you to weigh in and offer a counterpoint. What they want to do is take your counterpoint and, you know, make it, you know, hang it around your neck and make it very difficult for you to operate in a place like that. So, you know, we've gone through a whole thing. That was this whole bit of cancel culture. Mm-hmm. And again, I think what you're seeing, at least when I look at American politics, I see increasingly people on the right are like, okay, cancel culture, I'm not going to be against it anymore. But what I'm going to do is start canceling you.
Right.
And that's when it gets back to that whole frontier warfare metaphor that
we were using earlier.
So we are it's going to be a real challenge, I think, for a while.
Nick, we would be remiss if we didn't ask you one final question, just an off topic. Yeah. And that is, you are now in far away from home. You spent all your life far away from home. Now you're on the edge of the East and the conflict in Ukraine.
Right.
What is going on with the refugees streaming over the border, and what is happening there? How do you see it?
Well, I mean, I could say, like, here in Romania, the government has actually done a very, very good job working very, very hard to try to accommodate, like, what I understand is, like, probably about a million or some refugees who have fled from Ukraine into the country. And I was there not too long ago and saw the government's own efforts to, help these folks out. There were from the Romanian Orthodox Church. There were people from Israel, from Turkey, from Greece, from other places as well, who were pitching in and lending a hand, trying to help people when they came across, give them something to eat, look at them, give them a quick medical sort of thing. So I think that's been really remarkable, but I think that the longer this goes on, the potential for this overwhelming, whatever the resources are, is really great. And I've seen what that looks like before. I remember 1990, of course, after the first Gulf War, there was a huge influx, massive refugee influx into Turkey of about 500,000 Kurds who did not have limos and did not have cars. They were just walking up the mountains. And it was really, really a difficult thing. It was difficult for Turkey. It was difficult for the people there. It was just a real, you know, human disaster. And so Obviously, the longer that goes on, that's a problem. There are a lot of people here who, I would say the general attitude is that they, you know, very favorably inclined to the United States and very happy with their NATO membership, but also very, very worried lest the mismanagement of this situation that becomes such a problem that the war starts becoming a direct factor on their borders. And so I see that a lot on the popular level, see that in other places as well. So, you know, again, yes, it's great to be in NATO, but let's not have, you don't see people out in Eastern Europe, at least in this part of Eastern Europe, say Southeastern Europe, who are trying to pull the tail of the tiger. I think when I look further north, when you look perhaps in some of the other countries, in the Baltics and elsewhere, you're seeing some tiger tail pulling, which I think is ill-advised and very, very dangerous, particularly when you're talking about a Russia that has nuclear weapons and despite the best media spin that had dominated the first 100 or so years of the 100 or so days of the war, they seem to be somewhat wider acknowledgement now of their military success in the area. So at least in the eastern parts of Ukraine. So, cooler heads, it would be better if people adopted a cooler headed and more measured approach. And I think that would be certainly the average person walking around the streets of Bucharest or in Sofia or places like that would appreciate that.
The people of the world in areas like this cannot afford to think like puppies. Americans with our wealth, and even though it's dwindling now, and our politics, which are tomahawk driven, still think like puppies. But the people of the East, of Romania, Poland, throughout the Baltics, cannot think like puppies. And just one final closing note with Nick here, so that all of you who listen to this podcast know, this is the kind of conversation I have with my brother often.
Honored to be a part of it. It's very fun.
And as disjointed as it is, as we all do, it's kind of random.
Yeah. Come on, we didn't even talk. We didn't even talk about you breaking the ribs of the cattle and Dad coming into the cooler saying, "Nick, stop it, damn it! Don't hit the beef." You know.
And I said something like, "I can't haul meat no more," or something like,
like Pauly and Rocky. I can't haul meat no more. Yeah. Nicholas Cass, Nicholas Spiridon Cass of the American Conservative.
Yeah, check it out.
Check it out and subscribe to it. And I do. And it is a fascinating magazine. Now that your ideas have been cleared by the government and vetted, because we have to be responsible citizens. I wonder if you'll come back and we can talk about other things like the Orthodox movement in Romania trying to help on the edge of the border and other things that may be of interest to the people of Chicago.
I think that would be, I would love to do that anytime you want to have me. I would just say that as a former government official, you're not vetted in the sense that people say, "Oh, they like this particular point of view." Or not.
Oh no,
it's more, you know, helping you so that you don't, you know, inadvertently say something you ought not to, because, you know, as Constance Bonacieux told D'Artagnan many, in the Three Musketeers, "Ask me my secrets, I can tell you. Ask me the Queen's; those aren't mine to give." Right?
Because the world is Dumas. You know, the world is Dumas. And you still, okay, everybody, you still, Nick, just acknowledge that you stole the book 20 years after and took it for your own library.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. We're still going to have this thing?
Yes, we'll never stop having it.
Oh, my God. No, John, I cannot.
I love it.
I cannot talk to that. Anyway.
Brothers fighting.
Yeah, so good.
Nick,
thanks, guys.
Thanks for being a guest here. Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Love you, man.
Love you, bro. Love you too. Thanks, guys.
For Nicholas Spiridon Cass, my brother, longtime 30-plus year veteran of the State Department and intelligence community, a serious man who's written a serious piece, Lessons from a Turkish Coup, the country that invented the deep state, teaches us how it can be dealt with, in American Conservative magazine. And for Jeff Carlin, my friend, Nick's friend, executive producer, WGN Radio, now becoming a future physics teacher to teach the people, the young people of the city and the region, the secrets of the universe. That's not too ambitious. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com. Please subscribe. And after all, we are not communists, so, you know, I expect you to pay something. And join us again, won't you, next time for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Cool.
All right, buddy.
Sweet.
All right, so you need the mono, you know, couple, what? You're going to post Tuesday morning, so you need it Monday, right? Okay.
Yeah, Monday is good.
All right.
Yeah, if you get it, it'd be great.
We missed the window of posting the last column on the website. I'll try to post it today. The next opportunity is Monday for Tuesday, but you're going to have the other one up. I don't know what to do.
Well, I mean, we can push Nick back to Thursday to make it like Thursday for Friday. I can just.
All right. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. Cool. What are you guys doing on the 4th with your dad? Anything?
We're not doing anything tomorrow, but today we're taking my dad to.
You said the fight for drama.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big deal in Ontario. You know that?
Is it?
Oh my God! They have like competition. They're crazy. It's like a crazy competition.
Well, this is pretty intense, and they go all around the country. It's just brass, so it's drum and brass. So it's no
percussion.
Yeah, well, they have drums, but they have cymbals, and they have the horns, but they're not like fluted horns. So, like you're not playing like, it's not like a trumpet. It's like an actual bugle. So it's drum and bugle corps.
Where's the piccolo?
And I don't know if they have a piccolo.
Yeah. All right, buddy.
Well, right. Good luck with your pigs. I was just skimming that article. That looks great.
Well, there's a way to cook hot dogs. You know,
yeah, I saw that.
There's a deeper meaning in all that, but Regina asked for the. Oh, we got to do that because you'll see if you skim. There's a picture of Joseph's finest meats.
I see.
So you know, just whetting their appetite for us. Anyway, so yeah,
cool.
All right, buddy.
Well, enjoy.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you. See you, buddy. Bye. Bye.